There were black drapes over the windows, but Kroenberg separated them and stared out into the night. These two young men from Trans-Global Alliance Intelligence were really rather decent chaps. He was glad that he was not lying to them. The city, beyond the blackout drapes, was a shadow box of silhouetted shapes, punctuated by the glowing embers of fires which had burned in the aftermath of the Allied attack.
You see, there are degrees of evil just as there are degrees of good, my young friends. Few things are one or the other. The enlightened man must choose. The course of action, which Dietrich Zimmer wishes to follow, might well result in his goal being achieved. However, should it fail, the world will be plunged into a war from which it might never recover. The Jew, Einstein, when asked what the weapons of World War III would be, responded that he did not know, but that the weapons of the next war after that would be rocks and clubs. He was off by only a single war. Not bad, really. If this war is fought now, civilization will be in ruins. Who wishes to rule over that? I do not. Zimmer, on the other hand, is willing to risk that eventuality. He must be stopped. I had hoped to stop him myself. I discovered that such a dream was impossible from within alone. You see, Dietrich Zimmer has outguessed us all. Even the vile son, whom I had thought was dead, was never even in the slightest danger. The Martin Rourke Zimmer, whom I left to die, whom Dr. Rourke thinks that he killed, was never even there. Merely a clone.
A clone?
Zimmer's new scientific abilities, new to me at any event, were the determining factor which dictated that this temporary alliance was necessary. If there is God, Zimmer has taken to himself God's powers. Zimmer can create life, endow that life however he chooses. There is a report, most secret until now. I understand that Zimmer is using this report as the means by which he will entrap the entire Rourke family. When I learned of the report, I realized that if Zimmer triumphed, and the world survived that triumph, he would be master of the world for eternity.
Colonel, I'm not following you. I mean, I did all right in my science classes at the United States Naval Academy in Midway, but I trained for the Navy, not the laboratory.
Picture it this way, gentlemen. Dietrich Zimmer has perfected the means by which he can duplicate human beings and also the means by which he can record the human mind. He can then transfer the data in such a recording to any new mind. Undoubtedly, Dietrich Zimmer has cloned himself many times over. By use of cryogenic sleep, Zimmer can have a fresh body waiting for him whenever he needs it, either for spare parts or as a replacement for the whole. Ever since man first began to contemplate his own mortality, he has contemplated somehow being able to defeat it, to be immortal. Dietrich Zimmer has made himself immortal. The report touched only at the procedures. But I know Dietrich Zimmer as few men do. With his new abilities, he will live forever unless he is stopped now. His work totally destroyed. This is how it would work for him, gentlemen. Suppose that Zimmer has a series of alternate bodies awaiting his use. If he needed a heart or liver transplant, these bodies would be his donors, the perfect tissue match. Were he seriously injured, so gravely damaged that his body was beyond repair, the new body would be waiting his requirements. The doctor is a quite methodical man, gentlemen. With his abilities to record the human mind, I would venture to say that, as a safety precaution, he would have new bodies waiting which had already been impressed with his memories. In the event that some accident should befall him and there were no time to record prior to death or a bank of such recordings pre-existing, which is more likely the case, this could be accomplished quite easily. I understand from the data my own spies have brought to me that the recording process is painless, requiring only that the subject be awake. Once each week or even once each day, should Zimmer desire, he could record the contents of his mind, leaving instructions for their use should disaster befall him. For that, he has Martin Zimmer. Martin, of course, would be given similar treatment. Together, they would rule the world for all eternity, until the very planet ceased to exist as a cradle for life. Imagine, if you will, gentlemen, how it would have been if Alexander, or Napoleon, or Hitler, or Stalin had possessed this ability. The power which one could accrue in centuries of control would be limitless. With a mind as brilliant as Dietrich Zimmer's, no secret of the universe would remain unknown to him. He would bring about a new age, but only to serve his own needs. The processes by which he is capable of these miracles have been known to him for several decades. I imagine, gentlemen, that you are both still quite distrustful of me, as well you should be. But in this particular situation, I will prove your most faithful ally. And now I will tell you why. I am known as a merciless man, but there was one person for whom I craved mercy. My wife, gentlemen. And when she was taken gravely ill, I went to my comrade, Dietrich Zimmer, and Zimmer examined her. Her illness, however, was impossible to treat. As a conventional doctor, Zimmer did what he could, but the technology existed even then. That, had he wished for his most loyal man all these years, he could have recorded my wife's mind before her death, cultured from her body the genetic material required to duplicate her, excised from this material the defective gene which brought about her untimely demise. She was 28 years old, and we were married for only 7 years. Now, gentlemen, with mankind's lifespan expanded, I look forward, should I survive, to another half century without her. When in another decade, had Zimmer used his godlike powers to save her and me, she would have been with me again.
So, you want revenge for the death of your wife?
Not for her death, but for her not being allowed to be reborn to me. Do you understand, Darkwood?
I understand.
Then we have an arrangement.
Cronenberg was almost surprised that the American agent took it. The makeup technician tried powdering his cheeks, but Tim Shaw gently shoved her hand away.
No offense, ma'am, but I'm not into that stuff.
60 seconds!
The sound technician checked the wireless lavalier microphone that was clipped to Shaw's tie. The interviewer, Tiffany Coggins, seated herself on the other side of the little table between the two chairs.
Nothing to worry about, Inspector. Except after you leave here, I guess. This is hot stuff.
So are you.
This'll be on tape, so if anything goes wrong, there's no big trick to starting over.
Yes, ma'am.
You really intend to challenge the leader of this group of Nazi infiltrators to going one-on-one?
Not basketball, ma'am. But that's correct.
Roll tape! Camera one, move in a little closer on Inspector Shaw. Let's try it in 10, 9, 8.
Shaw watched the floor manager's hand as he ticked off the seconds, then nodded.
I'm here this morning with Inspector Timothy Shaw, head of the Honolulu Tax Squad. Welcome to Dateline Honolulu, Inspector.
It's good to be here, ma'am.
Please, call me Tiffany, Inspector Shaw.
Only if you call me Tim.
Tim? You asked for this interview, and as a part of Dateline Honolulu's continuing involvement in community affairs, we agreed. But I won't say happily. I understand that you will be placing yourself in considerable danger.
Well, that's not exactly true, Tiffany. I'm throwing out a challenge to this scumbag who caused the deaths of those kids at Sebastian's Reef Country Day School. The same piece of excrement who was behind the attack on my daughter's home, the one who was behind the assault on a missile shipment, who was too chicken himself to come after me just a few hours ago. Now that all his guys, or most of them, are dead, maybe he'll stop staying at home and come after me himself.
Then you want to make this a personal thing, Tim.
It's already personal, Tiffany. He's a Nazi scumbag and I'm a cop. That's as personal as it has to be. But if you're asking if I want to see if he's got the guts to try for me himself, you're on the money. Personally, a lot of the guys have been betting that he probably stays hid out all the time. Just, you'll pardon the expression on television, just jerking himself off every time he hears some innocent person getting axed by his boys. Me, personally? I think this guy's probably the kind who couldn't jerk himself off at all. Anyway, if he's got the balls to come after me, I'm gonna be up in the mountains near my daughter's place. He knows how to find it. His slimes tried getting to me through her, but she was too good for him. She's a Navy pilot, you know, and we're all proud of her.
And I understand, Inspector, that you're planning on waiting for this Nazi terrorist all by yourself? Why?
Well, that's right, Tiffany. And the reason for that is that this guy's too chicken to come after me any other way. If he thought I had a house cat with me, he'd probably use it as an excuse, afraid he'd get scratched. I'll be up, just tooling around in the boonies, having a good time. If he wants me, all he needs is the balls to try. You'll pardon the expression.
Do you have a description of this man, Tim?
How funny you should ask, Tiffany.
Well, we figure he's about 5 feet one or shorter. If that's so he can hide under rocks real good. His pants are always stained brown, if you know what I mean, and the tops of his shoes are always yellow.
No, seriously, Tim.
No, Tiffany. All we know is that this guy lets his people do all his fighting, which is why nobody has a solid description. Tell you what, Tiffany, I'd like to ask a favor.
If I can, Tim.
After I polish off this guy, will you have me back on the air so I can give your viewers first-hand details on how a slimy Nazi coward died? I think it would be enlightening for them.
You're that confident, Tim.
Well, a kiss for luck wouldn't hurt any.
No, Wilhelm! It would start a fire!
Wilhelm Doring didn't care, the upraised chair he held crashing down into the television screen.
Leave me alone!
He does not know you, this awful man. Does not know that you are brave and...
He is responsible, this man, for the deaths of all my men in my command. I can never go home again, Marie. Do you understand that? I could not live with the shame he has brought me.
We do not have to do this, Wilhelm. We both speak English. We could hide here, and no one would ever...
What is it you say?
I can work, Wilhelm. I can work, and you can...
What will you do? Sell your body on the street? That is all you are suited for. And I? Should I begin to rob banks? I am a soldier. I will die a soldier if I cannot live as a soldier. You may do what you will. A woman knows nothing of honor or duty. A woman finds a man, then becomes a parasite. It does not matter what you do, Marie.
I love you.
That is your misfortune.
I will help you then.
You will help me if you fall over dead. Only dead will you no longer be a burden to me.
Wilhelm!
Die, will you? I wish that you would die so that I could get about my business and kill this damn policeman, woman!
You do not mean...
What use are you to me or to yourself? You are no use to anyone or anything, and most certainly of no help to the cause. Do as you wish, but the only way you could be of any use to me would be if you died.
The crazy woman got up and ran into the bathroom. Doring would go to the mountains, find this Inspector Shaw, personally kill Shaw, and find some way of making an example of the policeman. What if he dumped the body at the police headquarters? Or the offices of Dateline Honolulu, right at the feet of this bitch Tiffany Coggins? That was the only thing a woman was truly good for, try as women might to be useful. They made adequate servants, but men were even better at that.
Marie! Get out of the bathroom! I need to clean up to get dressed! Stupid woman! Cry someplace else! I need the bathroom! Open the door! Stupid woman, open the door!
Wilhelm Doring threw his shoulder against the door. The door wouldn't budge. Shaking his head, he went to the bed they shared, his things laid out already for him. There was the little wallet there which contained his lockpicking tools. He took it, opened it, withdrew a pry and a pick, and then returned to the bathroom door.
I am becoming very angry with you, Marie!
Doring dropped to his knees before the lockplate, starting to work the tools. Then he noticed that his knees were wet. He looked down. He stood up. The tools fell from his fingers. Running out beneath the door was a growing puddle. He backed away from it. The puddle was not water, but blood. Anton Gabler merely awaited the word now. That final word would be given by Herr Dr. Zimmer personally to him by radio. He sat at his desk, watched the receiver, waiting for the buzz that would come from it. He would pick it up on the very first buzz, answering,
"This is Dr. Gabler."
Then there would be the code phrase. He would respond. Then Herr Dr. Zimmer would say,
"On my mark."
And he would give the word. Gabler would rise from his desk, walk across the room to the access control center, and enter. The mission clock, which Gabler would instantly set as the word was given, would be counting down. When he reached the controls, he would adjust their mission clock to match his own, then begin the countdown, commencing final arming procedures. Once he pushed the red button, his moment in history would be over. That was a very sobering thought. Gabler leafed through a report, too excited to pay it close attention. He set down the printout and turned to his computer terminal. He would bury himself in work until the buzzer sounded and his mission began. He summoned the file index, then acquired the file concerning his work in the salvage of nuclear material. He reread the earlier work in the field, eminently pleased with his thesis, sure of its potential success. He stopped, listened for the buzz. It did not come. Merely thinking about it, though, brought back the pleasant, warm stirring in his pants. No one had wielded such power for 625 years, except him.
Dr. Gappler here.
It is a fine day to begin the future.
Although we must never forget the past.
Firestorm.
Yes, Herr Doctor.
Gobbler hung up, activating the mission clock in the same instant. He stood up from his desk and walked across the room.
The center is sealed. The countdown has begun. To your stations.
Men and those few women who were capable of the work moved quickly to their posts. Anton Gobbler began the admission sequence into the transparently walled room at the far end of the laboratory, retinal and palm identification sequences underway as his fingers punched the buttons in secret to activate the master locking device. With an operation like this, nothing could be left to chance.
Firestorm.
By a different car, this one driven by Kronberg's personal chauffeur, James Darkwood and Manfred Kohl traveled to the same spot where they had arrived. The aircraft would be waiting as planned. Darkwood was beginning to have considerable faith in this arrangement with Kronberg. After all, simple revenge was easy to understand. The sun was up. Darkwood would have preferred to leave, as they had arrived, in darkness. That was impossible. Their discussions had consumed the night, and to have waited, losing another 12 hours, would have been unconscionable. Kronberg's chauffeur interrupted Darkwood's thoughts.
Gentlemen, forgive me, but we are being followed, I think.
James Darkwood twisted around in the car seat. The rear window defroster had been at maximum capacity, but from the center it cleared, and on the highway behind them there were two cars. The cars drove abreast and were closing fast.
Your Gruppenführer may have been found out.
I hardly think so, sir. These will be agents of the Gestapo who work independently. They monitor everyone. They will approach our vehicle, and if they feel that there is something amiss, they will ask to see papers.
Will our papers pass?
It would be better for the Gruppenführer if these men were not allowed to file a report.
Understood.
May I suggest, gentlemen, that the situations would best be served if I were to stop the car after the two of you were already out of the vehicle? The pursuit cars have not launched remote video probes yet, and there might be a chance. I believe that there is a curve just ahead. I could stop the car and then go on for another few hundred meters.
Just be careful yourself.
The highway along which they drove was somewhat elevated over the surrounding terrain. If Kronberg's driver stopped for just a second or two, he and Manfred Kohl could be out, flip over the highway guardrail, and hide along the embankment while the Gestapo vehicles passed.
Do what you think is best.
Yes, sir.
They were starting into the curve, Kronberg's driver speeding up as they entered it, leaving the two Gestapo cars well behind.
I will stop now!
Manfred Kohl threw open the door and was out, Darkwood after him into the brisk morning air. Manfred jumped the railing, Darkwood right behind him, but flipping it instead, going into a roll down the embankment.
James!
Fine, Manfred. You?
Ready.
Yes.
Darkwood pushed himself to his feet, swinging his left hand across his trousers to loosen the decayed leaves and pine needles and snow, then moving in a crouch up toward the guardrail. About 300 yards further down the road, Kronberg's limousine was stopped in the middle of the road with a Gestapo car in front of it and one behind. These parked at an oblique angle, preventing the car at the center from moving in either direction. Unless there were more men in the cars, he and Kohl would have six Gestapo personnel to deal with. Their cars were equipped with video, of course, but the video was not broadcast to headquarters as a matter of course. So with any luck, killing the men and destroying the video discs would leave things in such a manner that no finger would point at Kronberg. Darkwood thumbed back the hammer on the .45, upping the safety, his right thumb beneath the safety as he worked his way along the guard railing.
I will cross over to the other side.
No, because if they see you prematurely, then neither of us will be in position. That chauffeur who's driving is no imbecile. He's got a gun ready, too. I figure he can take the one approaching the car door and we get the other five.
Who placed you in charge, James?
Nobody, but I've been in more shooting situations than you have.
Agreed.
The Gestapo agent nearest the Unterscharführer went down. Darkwood thumbed down the safety. He put down the man nearest to Kronberg's driver. Manfred ran into the road, dropping to one knee. Darkwood flipped over the guardrail and ran into the road, firing again. Missing, Darkwood dove behind the nearest of the Gestapo cars. He threw open the front door, slid across the front seat, and threw the car into drive, stomping the gas pedal. Another of the Gestapo agents went down. Manfred and the chauffeur were chasing after the last man as he went over the guardrail and tried to flee. The other car was starting into motion. Darkwood stomped the accelerator to the floorboard and rammed it, throwing himself down across the front seat just at the last second. Darkwood crawled out, half falling to the pavement. As he looked up, he saw the driver of the other car running up the road. Hopefully, they were all dead. Darkwood started back to the cars, looking down over the guardrail as he did. Their guns at their sides, Manfred Cole and Kronberg's chauffeur were returning. James Darkwood slid behind the wheel of the car he'd driven and began sabotaging the video disc. There was a certain feeling of refreshment after the experience, a cleansing of self like nothing Dietrich Zimmer had ever imagined possible. Drained, emotionally and physically, he sat in the silence of his command center, eyes closed, reveling in the feeling of peace. In a moment, he would open his eyes, give the appropriate orders to his pilot, and the command center would be airborne over the battlefield, but only briefly. Anton Gabler's device would be launched in only moments, taking precisely 16 minutes and 43 seconds to reach the target. The aircraft would be into atmospheric insertion flight by then as assurance against electromagnetic pulse effect harming the instruments. Zimmer wondered, absently, what would be the effect if an EMP event were to take place while one were recording the mind. The idea was worthy of exploration at some time in the future. Zimmer opened his eyes now. He turned back the protective covering on the panel in his lap and flipped the toggle switch beneath it. The diode reader above the keypad cleared to zeros, and Zimmer tapped in the proper alphanumeric sequence, then opened the second protective cover. He depressed the button beneath it and leaned back. The recording he had just made was now being transmitted via one of the Transglobal Alliance's own communication satellites to the redoubt in what had once been the Himalaya Mountains, its location known only to himself and to Martin. Now, if anything were to go wrong, he would survive, even if this body were to be reduced totally to atoms. It was magnificent to be immortal, to know that death held no dominion. He powered the microwave transmitter and spoke into the microphone.
This is Dietrich Zimmer. The hopes of the Aryan peoples of past, present, and future go with you. Attack! The word is fire hunt! Attack!
As soon as his forces moved, the Transglobal Alliance forces would move to interdict. There had already been the warnings that such people as the leaders of these weak-willed nations liked to give, to withdraw, to fall back, to step down from attack posture. He had done none of this, but enjoyed the fact that they had been foolish enough to try. While they tried, they built their forces, ready to counter him, little realizing that they were sealing their own doom. Had he acted at once, invaded this community within the mountain, fewer of the Transglobal Alliance forces would have perished.
Ah, such fools.
He could feel his plane going airborne. He looked at the mission clock on the wall. Emma Shaw had slept fitfully, getting 6 hours in all, and not the sort of sleep that really did any good. John was off in the middle of nowhere, maybe getting killed. Her father and her brother were fighting saboteurs in Hawaii, and all she was doing was munching snacks and watching videos. This was insanity. Only about a half dozen pilots remained awake in the ready room. She had read a book, played three different types of solitaire, consumed half a bag of pretzels, even considered scrounging around to see if any of the other women among the group had any crocheting materials. She sat down in front of the large vidscreen and watched MTV.
Hey guys, anybody mind if I change channels?
Nobody answered, so Emma Shaw took the remote from its nest on the wall beneath the screen and began flipping. She found Eden's Channel 1, the official government station, and was about to flip past when she saw a face she had thought she would never see again. The face was all but identical to John's face and the face of his son Michael, but it was Martin Zimmer's face.
Few of you know me by sight, but you know my image. I am Martin Zimmer, descendant of John Rourke, adopted son of Dietrich Zimmer. Citizens of Eden, I make this rare appearance before you today in response to the unprovoked aggression of the air pirates of the Transglobal Alliance against our city. Thousands of you, my citizens, cannot hear my voice because you gave your lives for our nation. But in these next few moments, Revenge against the Transglobal Alliance will be ours, due to the resourcefulness of our National Socialist allies under the leadership of my adoptive father, Dr. Dietrich Zimmer. At the precise moment that this pre-recorded message to you ends, a new age will dawn and the combined forces of National Socialism will strike a death blow to our enemies. I speak, my citizens, of the power of the Unleashed at our command.
Oh my God.
We waited patiently, hoping against hope that our enemies would submit to reason. Yet, they have remained intransigent, forcing us to act before they can slaughter our peoples. Intelligence data have confirmed the fact that agents for the Transglobal Alliance have been attempting to infiltrate Eden City with suitcase-sized weapons of mass destruction. Each one of these agents has been caught and has admitted his or her crimes against the peaceful citizens of Eden and our gallant National Socialist allies. Yet, the specter of Holocaust could not be so easily dismissed as the unscrupulous plotters of death and destruction could be captured. It became necessary for Eden and the Nazi forces under the command of my adoptive father to launch a preemptive strike against the numerically superior forces of the enemy as a means of preventing your deaths and the deaths of your children. It is, therefore, my reluctant duty to warn the enemies of National Socialism that their armies of death will be reduced to ashes, and they have none other than themselves to blame. This message will end in a moment, as will the lives of vast numbers of the enemies of National Socialism. Be brave.
Eden's going nuclear.
The message dissolved into the Eden flag, the screen's image crackled, and the lights in the ready room flickered and died. Panic lights went on.
We're getting everything we've got airborne in case he's striking here. A lot of the ground stuff isn't hardened against EMP, so this is gonna be a fly-it-yourselfer. Let's go.
Emma Shaw grabbed her helmet and other gear. Running for the double doors, which were already open, the single thought that kept going through her head frightened her. The lights could have gone out for a wide range of reasons, but one of those reasons was an electromagnetic pulse, which meant that the nuclear device was very high yield, atmospheric rather than ground, almost certainly, and maybe quite close. She nearly stopped running and dropped her helmet. Emma Shaw knew the target. This was a trap, all along a trap. Dietrich Zimmer's forces weren't interested in the closed Aryan supremacy cult living inside a mountain in upstate New York. Zimmer wanted Transglobal Alliance forces arrayed around him so that he could strike them down. That was where the nuclear weapon was detonated. She found her helmet, grabbed it, and ran, holding back the tears. A lot of her friends would be dead by now, and a lot more were already dying. The time was still early, the morning young here. The sun in these northern latitudes at this time of year always low. The horizon was gray, the sun a dull yellow orb. But as John Rourke looked toward the east where the Nazi headquarters lay within and atop a mountain of living granite, there was a sudden brightness greater than that of the sun, as if the sun were multiplied or reflected many times over.
Get down! Cover yourself! Nuclear strike!
Rourke counted seconds. There was no blast effect, neither shockwave nor wind, nor was there any sound. He looked up, the bright floaters in his eyes all but gone. Although permanent retinal damage was still a possibility, it was unlikely. Rourke got to his knees. His binoculars lay in the snow, and he picked them up. The brightness was gone. He trained his binoculars toward the east. The artificial suns were gone.
The momentary danger's passed.
Natalia was beside him.
Nuclear?
Yeah.
Multiple independently targeted re-entry vehicles, or a single blast, do you think?
Multiple. I saw several suns on the horizon. My guess would be 10 one-megaton warheads air-bursting.
The usual pattern.
We're west of it, thankfully. The wind currents are easterly.
Dad?
For a long time, we all lived under the threat of nuclear weapons. And it looked as if everything would work out, that each side wanted seriously to disarm. Then the night of the war came. Now this was an air blast, which is substantially lighter on radiation. From what little I saw, it might have been as far away as the other end of the continent, and we're in no immediate danger. But I would venture to say that the Transglobal Alliance forces arrayed in what used to be upstate New York had been annihilated. There was probably a very powerful electromagnetic pulse. Today's aircraft are shielded against the effects as much as they can be, so depending on where a particular aircraft was and its particular electronics, some made it, some didn't. If the Nazis were the one who used the weapon, then quite soon one of the Allied nations will use such a weapon in response, unless Zimmer can be neutralized, and perhaps even then. What has happened doesn't alter our mission. We still have to get your mother and Wolfgang Mann out of there, if indeed they're in there, and then back to the plane. We'll still call in the support forces, but I don't think they're going to respond. Emma Shaw was going to lead the two squadrons coming when we gave the signal. The base out of which they operated might have been close enough to be heavily damaged, so air support may not be coming. And the aircraft that's been waiting for us to call in for the equipment drop might have been destroyed. Its mission was to stay airborne and refuel as needed. A multiplicity of things could have gone wrong.
Dad, if we find Dietrich Zimmer, we have to kill him.
I know.
Regardless of what that means for Mom.
I know.
I'm sorry, Dad.
I know.
Is this the end of everything, Dad?
It might be.
Then we should do like we did before. We do what's right, and go on doing that until we can't do it anymore.
Amen.
I hope all of you are right, you know, that there is a God and all, because we will need him on our side if we are to do any good. And I have to say something I should have said a very long time ago. Without loving you, John, I would never have become the person that I am. I've often felt guilty for falling in love with Michael. As guilty, perhaps, as you felt for falling in love with me so long ago. You've read Shakespearean tragedy, I know. And each of the characters who was central to one or another play had his fatal flaw. Yours is your perfection. If we walk into Zimmer's headquarters and rescue Sarah, give her up. Each of us here has someone not only to love, but to be loved by. Wolfgang Mann took this slip for one reason only. You taught me, John, taught all of us, that fidelity was the ultimate virtue, and also that it could be the ultimate sadness.
Rourke let go of his daughter and stepped back from them.
I'm going to finish, John. Emma Shaw loves you. If you both survive, be with her. She loves you like I did, perhaps more. Sarah would be happier without you, John. That's as plain to those of us who love you. It is so abundantly clear that neither of you is meant for the other, but you still refuse to believe it. You love the ideal of Sarah, but she isn't that ideal. It is very hard to be worshipped from afar, and very lonely.
Rourke turned away, not wanting to hear this, and he was disgusted not by Natalia's words, but by his own refusal to believe them. The one thing which had kept him going wasn't there. People thought of him as a hero. He knew that. He did not consider himself to be that. All he had ever been was a man devoted to his family, and that was all about to slip through his fingers after a lifetime of trying.
We need to get out of here and be about what we came here to do.
He picked up his pack and his rifle and started walking. Emma Shaw knew which aircraft to avoid as she got the fighter airborne, wishing all the while that she had another Blackbird like the one she'd lost after hitting Eden Plant 234. They were unmatched for speed and had state-of-the-art electronics. The V-Stahl fighter she flew, an F-200, was armored against electromagnetic pulse, but only so far as laboratory tests could manage that. So far, however, so good. The cargo craft not designed for use in battle zones were another matter, however, their electronics more closely matching those of the fighter aircraft utilized before the night of the war. One of the contributing factors to the Soviet Union's success in the wake of that horrible night of destruction was the more primitive electrical systems in their aircraft. U.S. and Allied planes utilized printed circuitry, while Soviet aircraft generally possessed vacuum tube technology. After an EMP incident, the Soviets could change the tubes and be airborne again. U.S. planes needed to replace entire circuitry panels. Current state-of-the-art employed shielded circuitry, in theory at least, proof against EMP, Emma Shaw hoped. Her two fighter wings were scrambled, most of the individual aircraft off the ground. Meanwhile, there were air crashes dotting the field. The cargo ships, out of battle zone, were suddenly without any electrical power and falling from the sky like enormous rocks, their flight crews never having a chance. The normal radio channels were all gone, and only ship to ship was working. She spoke into the microphone built into her helmet.
This is Bulldog Leader to Bulldog Pups. Standard defensive formation at following grid coordinates.
Emma read off the longitude and latitude from the screen of her navigation computer.
Until told otherwise, our mission is to interdict any incoming enemy ordnance until we run out of fuel. Stay on maximum fuel economy mode until ordered otherwise, or in case of emergency. I don't have to tell you guys, we may be staying up here until we're running on vapor. So watch yourselves. Nothing fancy. Let's have a moment of silent prayer for the crews of the downed aircraft and our forces in Operation Snowbird. This is Bulldog Leader, out.
They could stay airborne for quite a long time in maximum fuel economy mode, but what about John Rourke and the family? The purpose of her two squadrons being assembled in the first place was to support John's efforts at Nazi headquarters. Now, however, that would have to wait. No other fighter squadrons were airborne, and there was no telling how soon they would be. The fuel trucks, which serviced the aircraft, were not armored against EMP, and normal communications were totally disrupted. Computers wouldn't be capable of running, their circuitry fried. There was nothing to do but take up station in defense of the base and hope for word on how soon other fighter aircraft could get airborne to replace them, so they could get refueled and fly west. It was possible that the ground crews wouldn't even be able to reach them.
Oh, shit!
John Rourke dug in his poles and moved forward toward the edge of the ridgeline. Below him stretched only virgin snowfield, and beyond that a river valley, on the other side of which rose the mountain that was the Nazi headquarters. Human forms would not be detected on sensing equipment at this distance, so they could move with relative impunity. It would only be when they reached the mountain itself that electronic security might be a problem. But Dietrich Zimmer didn't want them kept out. Of that, John Rourke was certain. He was also certain of something else. What Natalia had said to him was true. Rourke signaled the others, then pushed off and down onto the slope. Natalia, the best skier among them, keeping pace with him quite easily. They were the only two who, before the night of the war, had ever skied for sport. Under normal circumstances, whatever they were, this slope would have been challenging but pleasant. Equipped as they were with packs and weapons, however, the slope was at once more difficult to navigate and more dangerous should they fall. A back could snap, a leg fracture. Whether the injury were complex or simple, a fall could result in death here. Rourke kept moving, guiding his skis into what seemed the natural contour of the mountain slope, Natalia staying slightly behind him now, Paul, Michael, and Annie strung out farther back still. It was true that Wolfgang Mann was in love with Sarah. It was true that Sarah would be better off without a husband who had never been very good at being there when he was needed, always off doing something, anything but what he should have been doing. The philosophical differences which had existed between them had melted away in the aftermath of the night of the war. She had learned that he was right to live for tomorrow by being prepared, but he had learned that she was right to live for today because tomorrow is uncertainty. It was true that Sarah would be better off with Wolfgang Mann. The old fedora had once been pearl gray, but its luster quickly disappeared. When he retired it from day-to-day use and devolved to what was his standard headgear, a black fedora, he had kept the hat anyway, just because it fit right. It became his sport hat. He wore it on those rare occasions that he was able to get away and do some deep-sea fishing, wore it when he got out trap or skeet shooting, wore it when he just knocked around in the woods. He wore it very little, which was why after 10 years of being retired from daily use, it really didn't look much worse than it had before. The vest which Tim Shaw wore was another matter entirely. Constructed to look like a photographer's vest, with pockets all over it which zipped and velcroed closed, it was constructed of the latest bullet-resistant material, and when closed at the front, featured an extra fold-under panel which could stop a slow-moving rifle bullet and almost any handgun bullet. Blunt trauma was another question, of course, and nothing was proof against that except the best of ceramics, and then only to a degree. But a bruise, perhaps even some internal injuries, hairline fractures and the like, anything was generally better than springing a leak. He carried nothing special in the way of armament as he left his daughter's little house behind and started up along the trail deeper into the mountains. In addition to his .45 automatic and his snubby .38 special revolver, he carried one of the two rifles he owned. The one still at home was a nice little .22. He'd taught Eddie and Emma how to shoot on it, then moved them quickly into centerfire handguns. The rifle he carried with him was identical to the one John Rourke used, a Lancer replica of the HK-91 in .308, what used to be called 7.62mm NATO, before the night of the war, when there was a North Atlantic Treaty Organization. In a musette bag hanging at his left side, Shaw carried spare magazines for the pistol and the rifle and spare speed loaders for the revolver. In a teardrop-shaped day pack on his back, he carried some food, a first aid kit, and other little necessities. A sleeping bag rolled up beneath the pack and suspended there on straps. With any luck, the man he wanted would come after him quickly enough and they'd settle the thing. While he, Tim Shaw, was tramping around in the boonies, the city of Honolulu was in big trouble. Evacuees from the eruption of Kilauea were coming in by the plane load. Other Nazi groups were engaged in various types of sabotage, and the entire Trans-Global Alliance was getting ready for war. The war would either start with, or early on, include an attack on the Hawaiian Islands in order to destroy the naval facilities at Pearl Harbor. Tim Shaw wanted only one thing. He wanted to see the man dead. The one thing Tim Shaw didn't bother to bring along was a pair of handcuffs. For once in his life, had he played the odds, John Rourke would not have been able to plan ahead. But he did not play odds, and he always planned ahead. Resting within a cave at the base of the slope before they attempted the river crossing, John Rourke had said as much to Paul and Annie, Michael and Natalia.
Dietrich Zimmer has calculated our options in advance and arranged for us to be right where we are now, ready to penetrate his headquarter complex. He's probably assumed that we'd leave whatever other forces were with us behind in favor of a soft penetration made by just the five of us. And he's right. However, he expects certain behaviors, and it's our obligation, if we're to survive, to do what he doesn't expect.
Commander Washington's force and the SEALs and Germans you brought won't be more than 10 minutes away once they're in position. But that can be a very long time.
Indeed, a very long time. Zimmer has anticipated every move we make simply because he's laid out an irresistible opportunity for us and left the only courses of action that would be logical as viable. He expects us to know by now that this is an elaborate trap, but he knows we'll walk into it anyway, which is exactly what we have to do, but hopefully from a slightly different direction. Now, the printout from the battlefield computer which you obtained, Michael, pretty much points the way we should go. We're faced with three means of entry. The first is the front entrance, which is heavily guarded. The second is the service entrance, which, as the force strength printout indicated, is lightly guarded and has less for us to worry about in terms of electronic countermeasures. The third way is the mountain itself. To climb that mountain would be close to suicidal. Therefore, Dietrich Zimmer anticipates that we'll come in through the service entrance or attempt the impossible to climb the mountain itself. But he's wrong on both counts. Zimmer is not expecting us to come in through the front because that would have been too obvious for him to hope for. So chances are it's normally guarded. And Zimmer has to take into account the fact that whatever backup forces we have will be waiting to strike as soon as called for or from a definite time schedule. The backup forces would logically come in from a different direction, not the same one we used. Now, since the mountain face is near to impossible for even a small force, and we would probably use the service entrance, that means that the main entrance would be the one to be assaulted by our backup forces. And we're going to reverse that, however. We're coming in the front, and Commander Washington's force will come in at the service entrance when it's time. If we still have any air cover, after the nuclear blast we detected, that air cover will strike against the mountain face. That means we have all three approaches, which are also the only means of exit, covered.
How do we get in the front, Dad?
It's funny you should ask, knowing that Zimmer would consider them too, and I felt that deviousness could best be combated by simplicity and openness.
We just go up to the gates and knock.
No, we're not going to knock on the gates. We won't have to.
I don't understand.
All right, look at what we know. Dietrich Zimmer evidently has access to every detail of our backgrounds, as much as is known at least by the Trans-Global Alliance, the United States, and the government of Eden. He's a skilled research scientist, and he's utilizing the same procedures with us that he'd utilize in the laboratory. We're the rats, and we're sitting right now in an ante room to the side of the maze we've been moving through ever since this started. He thinks he knows us so well that he can predict behaviors. And up until now, he's been right. He's even, I'm sure, predicted a conversation such as this. One thing he can't predict is that we would do something which is totally illogical. That wouldn't fit at all. Look at Natalia's KGB background, my background. We both have a long track record of such operations, and we know what doesn't work, so we'd never try that. Paul, your background in publishing and with computers, it's the same thing. And Michael, Annie, He's counting on the fact that the two of you have become so involved in the scheme of things that we do that those procedures are inculcated in you both. Dietrich Zimmer knows that I could no more ignore the option of potentially rescuing my wife than I could ignore the evil of his philosophy of national socialism and racial superiority. He knows that we have to do just what he wants us to do, but he can't anticipate a totally illogical response.
So then we do knock on the front gates?
Only figuratively, Natalia. Only figuratively.
What will we do then?
The classic ways in which one gets inside an enemy castle, which is basically the situation with which we are confronted, are these. One either storms the gates in force, surreptitiously goes over the walls, finds some sort of secret entrance, disguises oneself as friendly force members, or disguises oneself as some sort of harmless innocent.
Those are the only ways, aren't they? I mean, what's left?
There's nothing left. Which is why if we don't use one of the prescribed methods, Dietrich Zimmer will not be able to counter us, and we will slip past his trap because he won't know we're inside it.
How, Dad? By not going in at all, in a sense? At least not until the garrison leaves? What's going to make the garrison abandon the headquarters?
This should do it.
John Rourke took from one pocket of his backpack a small box.
And the others like it.
There was a combination lock set into the box. Rourke punched in the code. The box lid swung open. The box's interior was of heavy foam padding, as was the lining of the lid. Notched into the interior was a cutout, and nested there was a glass vial. Inside the vial, a pale green liquid.
Dietrich Zimmer, because he's so brilliant, is also somewhat cocky. And, as all of you now would be too polite to agree, if anyone should be capable of recognizing overwhelming ego, it would be me. Zimmer's ego, however, is the machine of his defeat and of our victory.
What's in the vial, Dad?
Annie, inside this vial is a serum. My backpack, which I left at the aircraft and retrieved after we knocked out Zimmer's forces there, contains little else but hypodermic syringes. Each of you knows how to use a syringe, and each of you will be called upon to do so.
The exhaustion came upon her so quickly that she was barely able to sit down. And now, after less than an hour, as she judged it, almost Sarah could barely keep her eyes open. And when she did, she saw two of Wolfgang Mann in the bunk opposite her. He had remained immobile for some time now, his chest rising and falling regularly enough. The real Sarah had been a nurse, and almost Sarah supposed that that was why she was able to view what was happening so clinically. The thing about him that was extremely odd was that his right arm had extended toward his head, but never quite made it. And it just stayed there, as if floating in the air, almost imperceptibly sinking toward his chest. At the back of her mind, one of the real Sarah's memories, no doubt, she remembered this as a symptom of some horrible disease, but she couldn't remember which disease, because her head ached so badly. The guard should have come with the midday meal, but no one had opened their door for a very long time now. Her joints hurt badly whenever she tried to move, and she would nod off, and when she awakened and tried to move, shooting pains ran through her arms and legs. Her mouth was dry. When she awakened this last time, and it was very difficult for her to know what was actual wakefulness and what was sleep anymore, she found that her right hand was moving, as if she were drawing a sketch of something. How long ago was it that she had actually drawn anything? She used to draw for children's books. But that was the real Sarah who did that.
Oh.
Wolfgang Mann was getting up, but he was still in his cot. There were two of him.
You are not the real Sarah. And you are evil.
I am.
Before she could say any more, the sleep came again. And she dreamed that she was with John and Michael and Annie, and they were in a beautiful valley. But there was something odd about John. He wasn't carrying his guns. In fact, he didn't have a single gun on his body. She could see that perfectly clearly.
Why aren't you armed, John?
Because everything is peaceful now, and I don't need to be armed at all.
She did not understand this, because things were not peaceful at all. Behind him, sneaking up on them, was this terrible man with piercing eyes, and she was holding her baby son, and her body ached almost as badly as it did now, and the man leveled the gun at her head and pulled the trigger. Although she knew it was impossible, she could see the bullet coming right at her head and feel it as it struck her head and feel the baby falling from her arms.
No!
But she had to hold the baby very tightly so he wouldn't be hurt, because he was perfect, and he looked just like Michael had looked, and that was just like John, and the baby was so special to her. Tears, pain, sleep.
What have you done, John?
I planned ahead for Zimmer bringing me into his lair.
And?
Between 1917 and 1929, there was a disease which baffled scientists nearly as much as did the AIDS epidemic. The disease was called encephalitis lethargica, and at first was improperly diagnosed because so many of the symptoms were identical to those of the influenza outbreak which followed the Great War and claimed so many lives. The earliest cataloging of the disease was by Konstantin von Economo of Vienna, a professor of psychiatry and neurology at that city's university, not from someone actually within the classic medical community. Cases were found most prevalent during the winter months. In 1924, at its height, it was a severe public health threat, but within 5 years, the disease had all but disappeared, leaving little behind but victims. Now keep in mind, of course, that there were 15 million people who died between 1917 and 1919 from the influenza outbreak. That was a tragedy of biblical proportions, a plague in every sense of the word, but a plague which could have been eradicated with some of the simplest of drugs that were so commonplace in the days before the night of the war. The disease, which is not to be confused with similar symptoms which resulted from the bite of the tsetse fly, was commonly referred to as sleeping sickness. Some sufferers experienced such marked symptoms that they fell into comas, and in some cases survived in this manner for years, even decades, never coming out of their sleep. Encephalitis lethargica's cause, although it is definitely known to be a viral disorder, remains unknown. However, it can be duplicated and redesigned.
My God!
Schlafkrankheit, the identical disease, perhaps, or quite similar strain, struck Germany in the 18th century. Some cases of what could be interpreted as encephalitis lethargica were reported in England prior to the general outbreak at the beginning of the 20th century. The same diseases reoccurred among the population of New Germany during the period in which we took the last sleep. Involuntary muscle spasms, rapid breathing, muscle aches, headache, and a wealth of other symptoms besides the obvious one of profound sleep were exhibited. The one conclusive symptom which evinced itself was double vision, uncommon in influenza, and this peculiarity led to the discovery of the disease. I anticipated, when Dietrich Zimmer contacted us to set up the initial meeting to exchange Martin, whom I'm sure now he knew even then was dead, if indeed the man I killed was Martin and not a clone, I anticipated that Zimmer would, because of his ego, invite me to see his facility, invite me to view Sarah. And it only seemed logical to assume that something wasn't right, that the trade would never be accomplished, and that if I had the chance to be inside the enemy headquarters, I had to capitalize on the opportunity, effect whatever positive value from the episode that could be had. So, I considered my options, and I arrived at what I found to be the only viable solution. Disease. Of course, I had to select the proper disease, so that it would strike quickly and profoundly, but be susceptible to a cure. I had no desire to be a mass murderer, nor certainly to cause the deaths of Sarah or Wolfgang Mann. There was little chance that any true military solution was possible, and since Zimmer was possessed of such great intelligence, there was little chance of using guile to obtain the inevitable end we would seek. So, I went to the finest medical library in Hawaii, and I discovered that encephalitis lethargica had occurred in New Germany about 50 years ago, and although many were stricken, modern medical technology was able to effect a cure through a vaccine, which would prevent the disease among those persons not already infected. I consulted with intelligence in New Germany in order to find the medical authority most conversant with the disease, and I explained my potential problem, and she assisted me in developing very quickly, because we had precious little time, both the vectoring method and the other details required. Another reason for selecting encephalitis lethargica was that it had occurred at about the same time in Hawaii. Medical personnel from New Germany shared their technology and specimens of the viral agent as it existed in Hawaii, and it was perfect. But I had to think of a way of distributing the virus in such a manner that it would actually grip the majority of the population within the Nazi headquarters. For that, I required an innocuous method of disseminating the virus. Paul, do you recall my having a delivery made from Lancer Firearms just before our aircraft left for Canada?
Yeah, I don't understand what that has to do.
I had a magazine for a German MP40 sent to me. Pulled the follower and the spring, placed the follower in the top of the magazine in such a manner that it would pivot, and used the magazine as the container for the aerosol. Nothing harmful to the ozone, of course, but used the magazine to contain my vectoring device. The spare magazine was stuffed in the waistband of my trousers when I borrowed your Schmeisser as a close-range weapon when I went to visit Dietrich Zimmer's headquarters. As I moved through the building, I merely tapped the single cartridge I'd glued to the follower of the Trick magazine. This released a small amount of the contents of the container secreted within the magazine. I spread that virus throughout every area of the compound through which I was brought.
That's incredible.
But of course, I'd already had myself vaccinated and had the clothing I wore treated with a compound which prevents viral contaminations. So, I did what I came for, and I left, leaving behind enough viral agent to incapacitate thousands of people, and very quickly, within approximately 48 hours, dependent, of course, upon the general state of the individual's health. And I had enough vaccine produced. That was another criterion, which fortunately the disease allowed that vaccine could be procured within hours using modern technology. But I had enough produced that I could safely be able to vaccinate 3 times the number of infected persons. By now, the entire headquarters complex will be stricken. We can walk in. And of course, anyone who left the facility, such as Dr. Zimmer, will require the vaccine as well.
Couldn't this start an epidemic?
Not really. The virus doesn't survive in extreme cold temperatures, and Dietrich Zimmer's army will remain an integral unit. As soon as our business here is done, for humanitarian reasons, Zimmer's forces will be notified, and whatever quantity of vaccine might be required will be supplied. After administration of the vaccine, symptoms disappear in less than a few hours. It was all total luck, but it's our ticket in and out alive with Sarah and Wolfgang. Now, let's everyone roll up his or her sleeve and we'll get started.